Let me, we're going to get started. We have two big bills this morning. We've got Representative Capp's bill, and then we're going to continue the discussion on Representative Swale's bill. We are at quorum, and I'm wondering, Representative McFarland, we've got a couple of minutes from both March 10th and March 11th that we need to have moved. If you would be so kind, I'd appreciate it.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative McFarland moves the minutes of March 10th and March 11th. Members, those are in your package. I hope you've looked at them carefully. And so, any discussion? If not, then all in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Thank you, members. I appreciate it. And by the way, you know, for the public, you know, these minutes are posted on our website. And I actually used the members the other day. I was looking, trying to remember someone who offered testimony. I couldn't remember the person's name. And it was very handy to have it there. But I certainly encourage the public to, you know, to go and look at the minutes if they ever want to see what we've been up to. So it is important that we move these things officially. And then, by the way, members, the governor and I and the majority leader and the speaker are all in agreement this morning that this will be the last sub-zero morning until, I don't know, what do you think, December 15th? Yes, bipartisan weather. Bipartisan spring. How's that? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign, motion prevails. Representative Cass, House File 1484.
Yes, I'd like to move House File 1484 that it be recommended to pass and I think laid over for possible inclusion.
Representative Cass, that's correct. We're going to, we're desiring to do that. So the bill is before us and this show is all yours.
All right. Well, thanks. You do have an A3 amendment that I'd like to bring up first to put it in order as to what we'd like to see presented right now. So if you take a look at the A3 amendment, it's pretty straightforward. I will incorporate that into the overall bill when I go through it. So if we can incorporate that first.
Very well. Representative Cass moves the A3 amendment, and he'll explain that as he goes through the bill. In my understanding, this is modifying some of the auditor's timelines, so nothing that...
And part with the Department of Education, too. They had contacted me about something with the legislative auditor's report, and so wanted to be amenable to their wishes.
Very well. All in favor of the discussion? All in favor of the A3 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Cass.
The theme about this bill, I guess, as we kind of go through here, and the first thing that was amended on it is through the title, and that is taking a look at refocusing on practice. And the fact that when we talk about best practice in teaching, where we're moving with staff development throughout the state and the nation, a real emphasis is placed on teaching practice. And the fact that when we had individuals come in as they were talking about the legislative auditor's report on QCOM, once again it came back to those schools saying that it provided some effective practice measures, some performance goals, there's some funding for staff development. As well as we're looking at what is it that we're going to do to push forward the idea or the concept of effective teaching practice, and this is what the bill is attempting to accomplish, and I think it does. First and foremost, I worked on this with the Minnesota School Boards Association, with representatives from the University of Minnesota, met with Education Minnesota, representatives from MACDI, and also a bunch of different legislators as we were kind of going through this process. I was trying to incorporate everybody that we possibly could, and of course the Board of Teaching, because the first component here under Section 1 definitely deals with that. First and foremost, it looks at the relicensure process, and one of the things that I think needs to be done as we're taking a look at effective teaching practice is making sure that relicensure applicants are reflective in the way in which we obtain relicensure. And one thing that we can do to encourage that is to put within our relicensure requirements that reflection and evidence-based documentation of what it means to be effective in your practice is a component of that relicensure. So on page 1, paragraph B, there, sorry, on 1.21, it talks about relicensure applicants and specifically having reflective statements and showing some evidence of professional growth. And then on the top of page 2, it gives some components by which that evidence and those reflective statements should be addressed. So looking at supportive student learning, use of best practice techniques and their applications to our student learning, collaborative work with colleagues that looks at collegiality, attested to committee work, collaborative staff development programs, and professional learning community work. As well as in the fourth one there, continual professional development that may include job-embedded professional learning during the relicensure period. And it gives some context of what evidence may look like and how that evidence can actually be brought forward and be reflective in nature. One of the things in an area that I think as a teacher I kind of pushed me forward in trying to introduce this was that a lot of the embedded job-embedded staff development cannot count towards your relicensure as it is currently structured. For instance, I did some research on the ways in which I put students together in grouping clusters in my advanced placement economics and AP government courses. And I did some research using Eric Jensen's brain-based learning and looking at the way in which different learning styles can be incorporated, looking at how our students are different in the context of how they learn. And I did that research on my own, put those kids together, and throughout that it was action research that I was implementing in my classroom. But in no way through the 120 clock hours that we are required could I document that and use that for my relicensure. When in fact I would say that wholeheartedly it was one of the most influential pieces of impact in my classroom, but yet it was not considered then a clock hour. So what this is really trying to do is say that we have some best practices going on in our classrooms. We have teachers that are working each and every day to look at new and innovative approaches in their classroom. Why not make this relicensure, and specifically when you hold that document in your hand, that you know that it's effective of what was going on in your classroom and that you can actually attest to the fact that the activities that I am putting forth and the research that I am doing and the evidence that I'm showing is supported through relicensure. And kind of further evidence, I got this in the mail yesterday at my home school, that I can become a super teacher. All I do need is 5 hours, and I will get all of the requirements to relicensure met in one day by going to this, and I can be a super teacher. And I look at this and say that some of the hoops that we jump through for relicensure right now and saying that in one day I can fulfill all the requirements that will make me the super teacher, and I would say that I look better than this. The photo that's on here, but the idea is that for relicensure, we understand that there needs to be some clock hours put into this. But overall, shouldn't we open this up to also look at the job-embedded staff development that's already being put in place and the best practice there? So that's section one there. Sections 2, 3, 4, and 5 start to kind of get some new language and some components to what it is to be a mentor or a peer coach when it comes to impacting best practice. And really what it is an update of language. The statutes are already there, so section 2 and 3 look at the peer review process for probationary as well as in the peer review process for continuing contract. Change the titles that we give that because I think it's more in touch with what we're currently doing and currently seeing within our schools. So for instance, under section 2 on line 2.24, changing from peer review to mentoring for probationary teachers. Mentoring is more all-encompassing of what we want to do with our probationary teachers. Peer review may be a part of mentoring, but mentoring has a much larger context by what it is that we want to do for those teachers and through the induction process. So I want to kind of advance that language and make sure that we are looking at the overall process of what we want to do rather than just focusing it on a review structure. Same way with section 3 there, looking at coaching for continuing contract teachers. Again, review may be a part of coaching, but coaching then offers a little bit more evidence of what it is that we can do to support all of our teachers through a multitude of practices. So the process, and then we added some language that the process may include having trained observers such as mentors or coaches or having teachers participate in professional learning communities. The sections 2 and 3 then are for general context for schools, and sections 4 and 5 are for our first class cities schools, and those are same language, just that it's mentioned two different places in statute. Then we get in under sections 6, 7, 8, and 9 under the QComp language, and I said, you know what, as we're taking a look at this and looking at effective teaching practice, I could not help but, you know, the day that we had those school districts come in and the individuals come forward that were talking about how they were implementing QComp, And really that focus, I think, needs to be about, well, if it is helping some of these school districts to provide great job-embedded staff development, then I wanted to look at the language about what it means to provide for effective teaching practice. And that's really what these sections are all about. First off is the plan that must be put in there, which is the improvement plan under section 6 there on the bottom of page 3. We did a few changes there under number 4 on line 3.28, a rigorous research and practice-based professional development system. Again, that the emphasis is on practice, based on national and state standards of effective teaching practice. We have the standards of effective teaching practice in place in our state that we require all of our newly trained teachers to implement before they become a teacher. Why not put that in statute under any of these other staff development plans? That those should be re-examined so we can have a common conversation between existing teachers and new teachers about what it means to be an effective teacher. Then going on to page 4, near the bottom there, it goes into the actual QCOMP language, the alternative teacher pay professional system. Under line 4.3, we focused on the idea or concept of evidence of effective practice. Again, this is a change of saying that what we want to examine here through this process is evidence of change, specifically of how we see effective practice by our teachers. And so what we put in there under 4.33 is looking at reflection and growth and best teaching practices, again, linking it to the way that we re-license our teachers. So in other words, if a school is implementing this QCOMP program, automatically under section B there on the bottom of page 4, it would be working towards that teacher's relicensure. Again, job embedded, a movement and a flow of a systemic system of getting those licenses to mean something through staff development. Then on the bottom of page 5, or in the section 8 there, is just the language that has been changed in accordance with the legislative auditor's report. Specifically, one thing that was changed in the amendment that should be noted is on line 5.21, we took out the March 1st, June 1st, October 1st. The department would like to see it added as the commissioner annually must establish 3 dates as deadlines. They said by having it in a statute as three dates might be somewhat too restrictive for them. Let them set the dates, and really I think that's good practice for them. And finally, then on the last page, their lines, or page 6, starting at section 9, is looking at the contents of the staff development plan itself. Again, being rooted in a concept and a structure of ensuring that the contents of the plan are looking at effective teaching practice. And focus then with the relicensure requirements, bringing back again from the first section and saying that we need to have reflection and evidence-based teaching practice, and then supports the plan of saying that we must support stable and productive professional communities, emphasizing coaching and professional learning communities, other job-embedded models, strong subject matter focus, specialized preparation in the area of teaching with special needs, limited English proficiency, as well as then reinforcing our national and state standards for effective teaching practice. With that, I'd like to bring up Dr. Missy Sato, who will offer some background and context on professional development, then Karen Ballmer with the Board of Teaching, and then we'll open up for questions, if that's all right.
Thank you, Representative Katz, and thank you for the wonderful walkthrough of the bill. Dr. Sato. I think it's Sato or Sato?
Sato.
Sato. Dr. Sato.
I think it's said it 17 different times,
yeah.
17 different ways.
That's right. It's good to see you again, Dr. Sato. Good morning.
Representative Marion.
Please. You'll need to identify yourself for the record.
My name is Misty Sato. I am a professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Curriculum Instruction. My research sits within the world of teacher professional development and looking at the professional teaching continuum. And my comments today are going to be based on a research-based conceptual model of thinking about teacher development as a professional continuum from pre-service practice up through master teacher, accomplished teacher practices, as well as a synthesized research document that's been recently released from the National Staff Development Council, primarily authored by Linda Darling Hammond, released in 2009, that provides a synthesis of research on teacher professional development, not only here in the United States, but also internationally, and some of my own research on effective professional development practices. I'm going to talk about teacher learning, student learning, and school change, and how all three of those pieces are linked to professional development, that sits on three primary principles. That teacher professional development that's effective is linked tightly to what, to the what of teaching, the content that's being taught in the classroom, and to the how of teaching, to teaching practice. In essence, the focus of professional development for teachers should be on what students are learning and how to best support them toward that learning. Effective professional development is also embedded in the working context of the teacher, and it's aligned with school-wide goals. So the days of individual teacher professional development and the effectiveness of that are starting to dwindle, and we're really looking at effectiveness as being situated in school-wide professional learning opportunities for teachers that are tightly linked to their daily practice in their classrooms. Finally, the research emphasizes that effective professional development should be sustained over time through classroom inquiries and collegial interactions. This means that the time needs to be allowed not only for the introduction of new instructional techniques through workshops and institutes, but also for allowing teachers to test out those ideas in their practice, to work with their colleagues and reflect on those new practices with their colleagues, and to really tweak those practices for their individual context. Educational leaders in this field are in consensus that there is no foolproof instructional practice that could be applied to every classroom, to every student in the country, that any practice that's suggested as best practice needs to be flexible and adapted to the individual context of the teachers. And that happens through inquiries in the classroom, with the example that Representative McCaff gave from his own teaching practice, and through collegial discussions and mediation. So I want to keep these principles in mind as we build professional development systems for teachers that will have an impact on practice and student learning. If we tweak one part of the system of professional learning for educators, we need to be aware of how that may or may not impact the long-term development of a teaching career and other school change efforts that are in place. We need to work toward and maintain coherence in the professional learning systems put in place through state policies, school and district policies, and higher education policies. So we really need a system view on how professional learning works across this continuum. So the pre-preparation requirements that are being promoted in other action, I do want to make a comment about that as being part of the professional continuum. That in teacher preparation, we have a number of inputs for learning, and those are shifting from coursework and clinical practice that are separated to models that are tightly linked together and moving to job-embedded or residency models for professional practice schools for how to prepare teachers. So the inputs are shifting from individualized experiences to more holistic experiences for pre-service teachers. We have multiple measures are used to determine the results or the outcomes of these inputs for teacher learning. Candidate performance on standardized exams, reliable performance assessments that provide measures of the quality of teachers' practice, and measures of the learning of the candidate students. So here we are looking at not only inputs, but also the outputs. What kinds of outcomes do we get, or do we start to look for that say that candidates have learned what we expected them to learn? That leads to a decision licensure. The next comments are on the changes to for probationary teachers, which are the changes in Section 2 and Section 4 of the bill. The purpose of the change is to alter the transition into teaching from being a process of review to a process of induction, and induction being a guided, supported means for a beginning teacher to gain experience. So again, if we look at inputs to the early careers of a teacher, the older models are you gain experience. You come in, you get your experience. It's more of a sink or swim kind of model that says if you get experience, then you'll carry forward in your professional career. We're starting to shift nationally and internationally to significantly in the professional field. Research shows that guided induction experiences is much more beneficial to launching a teaching career and results in better retention of teachers. And inputs for this learning of the teachers are in the induction phase include not only that teaching experience, but feedback on instructional practices by a mentor and guidance in improving practice by mentors, peer coaches, or colleagues. Minnesota has not yet provided funded legislation to ensure that all teachers have access to induction support, such as mentoring. We have some stellar examples in the state that are housed within districts, but we have no statewide guidelines for what high-quality induction would look like for all teachers to have access to that in their early career. the outcomes of providing these inputs into professional learning are improved practice as measured against descriptions of instructional practice along several dimensions. This is where the state standards come into play, and that those standards become the guidelines for establishing measures of improved practice. The decision point here in the professional continuum is moving from probationary license to a professional license or moving to a tenured status in the school system. Then we move to ongoing professional learning, and these next comments are about changes in the continuing contract for teachers in sections 3 and 5. After induction, teacher professional learning is an ongoing and important part of the educational system's quality. We know that the quality of teachers is one of the key factors associated with student learning, and we invest most of our money in educational systems and teacher salaries, so it makes policy sense to invest in the professional learning and maintaining high quality among our teachers. You might think that a teacher's professional career, that there's something you learn and then it plateaus, but we know that the world is changing, student demographics are changing, expectations for learning are changing, so we need to keep all of our professional teaching staff apprised and in the learning process throughout their career. Some typical inputs for the professional learning in this phase are college coursework, advanced certificates and master's degrees, workshops, special institutes, and conferences. These things are easily measured in terms of clock hours. They provide very distinct point-in-time opportunities for learning. And Minnesota has rules, current rules in the board, from the Board of Teaching, where teachers are required to amass 120 clock hours of professional learning every 5 years to make the relicensure decision. But we want to talk about outputs for this part of the professional learning right now, because right now the system is about inputs, about how much time do you put in to your professional learning practice, this 120 hours, and where do we look at outputs to make those relicensure decisions. We're not currently asking teachers to report what they are taking away from their many professional learning opportunities in which they engage or how those learning opportunities are helping them to improve their teaching and professional practice as a result of those, as a result of those inputs. So part of this relicensure process is missing the output dimension on professional learning, and that can be provided in a number of ways, one of which is through the teacher's descriptions and reflections on how they have taken these inputs and brought them together, synthesized them into improved opportunities for student learning, improvement in practice, improvement in collegial relations in the school. There's another dimension that I'll just mention briefly because of limited time, and that's moving teacher to master teacher or teacher leadership processes. There are many opportunities for teachers to be leaders in professional learning of their colleagues through coaching, facilitating, and mentoring, and we know from research that that teacher-to-teacher connection is very important for ongoing professional learning. And we have significant national measures that determine from an output model what accomplished practice looks like, one of the most notable ones being national board certification. Minnesota has statute about national board certification and has recognized that that is a significant measure of accomplished practice. And again, that level of the system has some output measures already in place. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Sheffield. Members, it's the chair's desire that we take this bill no longer than 9:15. We do have another bill that is quite substantive. I've got a number of questions already lined up, but what I'd like you, do you have one other testimony?
Karen Balmer with the Board of Teaching.
Perhaps, and Ms. Sheffield, please stay nearby. Ms. Balmer, if you can come down. If we can take your testimony, and then I want to open it up for questions. We have about three or four members that have indicated they have questions. Good morning, Ms. Balmer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Karen Balmer with the Minnesota Board of Teaching. I'll keep my comments brief and to hopefully save time for your questions, but I was asked to provide just a bit of context and background with respect to the current system that we have for the relicensure and license renewal of teachers. In a nutshell, we do require under Minnesota rule that sits under the authority of the Board of Teaching, that's where you'll find most of the language relating to relicensure. We do require 125 clock hours per 5-year renewal period. There is some language in statute as well that relates to teachers' relicensure, and that's found in Minnesota statute 122A.09, and there you will find actually four requirements within the 125 clock hour requirement that teachers must meet for the purpose of renewal. And those broadly have to do with reading preparation, identification of early onset mental illness in children and adolescents, positive behavior intervention strategies, and then the final one has to do with adaptation of curriculum and materials. So there are four specific requirements within the broad umbrella of 125 clock hours as mandated in statute. And like I said, the rest of the requirements are found in Board of Teaching rule. I should also note that the Board of Teaching is pursuing right now, in its rulemaking authority, the addition of one more requirement that has to do with technology that would also be required within a renewal period. So that's some broad background. Specific to the legislation that you have before you, we believe that this will take us in sort of a new direction in terms of the paradigm for relicensure, that it will focus on the reflective practices that you've heard already spoken about this morning, and that it will support the initiatives and the research that we know is helpful and valuable for teachers and in their professional growth and development. So we at the Board of Teaching are very interested in this discussion and wish to support your work in this in any way that we can. And I think I'll pause there and see if there are questions.
Wonderful. Thank you, Ms. Palmer. Let me do a couple of, at least one technical thing first before we get into question. I'm told, Representative Cass, that we need to do a technical fix to the A3 amendment. So members, if you can pull that back up, you can track it. And perhaps I can ask our staff to help us walk through that, or is that... you need the language, don't you? Yeah. Ms. Larson.
Mr. Chairman, members, Representative O'Mueller was careful enough to read through this. And
perhaps we should give him the floor so he can speak to it. Representative O'Mueller.
You get credit for being... well, anyway, the proposed amendment would be on line 7 of the A3. With the language that's currently in the bill at 5.28, we need to strike the word receiving and add the word the before most. So it would be line 28, strike receiving, and then we're already striking it.
Mm-hmm.
But we need to add the word the most recent application deadline, just to make that sentence read properly.
I need
that motion, please.
So members, you'll have to obviously turn to the bill as introduced to go to page 5 on line 28, where we would strike the word receiving, and then back to the A3 amendment, which is now incorporated into the bill, insert the word the in front of most recent application deadline. Representative Obermiller would so move. Representative Cass.
Yes, that sounds great.
Wonderful. members, discussion? All in favor, please say... Oh, I'm sorry.
Not really.
Oh, okay. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Hold same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Obermiller. And then we do have an amendment by Representative Peterson. I'd like to get to that, and then we'll open this up for the discussion. Representative Peterson, I believe you want to move the A1 amendment. Is that correct?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this comes about after a fair amount of discussion with Representative Taft. We've been working on this together to address some of the potential concerns that might come up from staff. And it is just changing some minor, making some minor changes. As you can see, changing must to may because not all districts might be ready to move to this particular piece of relicensure. And this does give the options and to continue with the current system that is in place and use some of these components as they change. And so that was one of the things that we thought was necessary. The second one is really a technical change. And the third one just allows teachers to still be able to count their classwork at a university or ongoing kinds of training that might be appropriate for their particular area of teaching. So this is an expansion, really, of what teachers are currently doing, and it's a very exciting change, I think. We're moving teachers in most districts where they're dealing with continual professional development are already doing most of these things, and this will provide an opportunity for the Board of Teaching to begin to look at what is in this particular document, clock hours to it and begin to get credit for what they are doing in the classroom to become more proficient in their practice. And so I think these are good amendments and ones that we look at, and I was very excited to work with Representative Taft on this document.
Very well. Representative Peterson moves the A1 amendment. I look for advice from the author here on this. Without knowing this issue really well, I want to make sure that we are moving proactively here and that we're not, I hope I'm not hearing this wrong, that we're not creating just sort of, you know, a perpetual softening. I think what we have is a proposal here that moves us, I think as Ms. Palmer paraphrased it, kind of in an important paradigmic way based on research. And so I just want to make sure that we're not violating that sort of concept. Representative Kapp.
Yeah, you know, in my conversations is the idea of our school districts at this point in time able to move towards this type of language, and by no means do I want to place an undue burden or another mandate that is unfunded on a school district. I will say, though, that by changing from must to may, it does put towards the Board of Teaching still the authority, as well as kind of the impetus to say that you need to create some rules that are going to allow this to happen. But the fact of whether or not school districts will take this approach. So I am welcome to the concept of May being added there, but I hope within my tenure here as a legislator, as well as in my years as a teacher, that I will see this go to a must, and that is that we will see teachers all being very reflective within their practice, and that every single component of relicensure will have a reflective piece to it.
Members, let's discuss the amendments. Representative Norton.
Well, Representative Kapp, having passed a bill my freshman year that said must and have it changed in conference committee to May, and not having had the support yet to change it, I would recommend that you not accept the language. And in fact, my comment, which I can just say now and I won't say later, was that you have May in here way too many times if you really want to do something substantial. And I think must in all those instances would be better.
Representative Demers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wonder if the concern, because I got to agree with Representative Norton, and quite frankly, I agree with you, Representative Kapp. I think it's changed significantly. But, you know, one way to look at this may be to, if the concern is whether school districts are prepared or if this is coming too quick, maybe delay the implementation by a year.
Well, the implementation is delayed until 2012,
if you would ask,
Mr. Chair, that the implementation is on relicensure beginning July 1st of 2012.
I was looking at
that. Can you show us where
that is online?
2.22.
So in other words, what we're looking at here is the biggest thing for myself and in talking with Ms. Palmer is that I wanted to make sure that the rulemaking authority was still given to the Board of Teaching. Now, that was not my the will of myself, is that I didn't want to influence any rulemaking. So we looked at the fact and the components of saying that that is what has been given to them. What this is looking at is a direction, and that in statute we wanted to make sure the Board of Teaching saw a direction and a national direction that is out there, and that is the fact that looking and focusing on reflective practice is what our goal was here.
Representative McFarland and Downey on the amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have concerns about line 1.4 on the amendment because, Representative Kapp, I felt that the job embedded was important to you, and I would suggest that maybe instead of deleting that part, you might add the ongoing formal education or other to that line instead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, in talking with Dr. Sato, we were wanting to make sure that got in there within the amendment itself, that word was deleted, but we wanted to make sure that it was there. We felt as though that, or I felt as though that it was still in there in the current context of reflective practice within the classroom, but again, then making sure that job embedded was there, so we would be welcoming that brought back in, and we would like to see that done.
Representative Downey.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Maybe first just a process question. Would this go right from our committee to the floor, or is there is this being referred?
Mr. Chair, members, Representative Downey, that it right now is being laid over for possible inclusion.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Thank you. And then a comment, and I think it's germane to this amendment and the discussion we're having. I observe under 122A.70, teacher mentorship, where the districts are only encouraged to have such a teacher development program, and I was observing the same thing, that this nuance of may versus must, I think, is an important one substantively to your proposal, but also in terms of its correlation to some other areas of statute. So I support the bill and the concept and the direction we're heading, and would just maybe suggest that between now and the omnibus bill, that some of these issues get fleshed out a little more and maybe crisp up the language and across the bill and with relation to other areas of statute too, but support the direction. Thank you.
Great, thanks. And Mr. Chair and Representative Downey, I would note then too also under subdivision 6, where it does talk about mentoring for probationary teachers, it does show that must develop a probationary teacher peer review process through joint agreement. So in other words, through the mentoring, through that language, we will hopefully achieve that under the rule of must.
Representative Norton.
My comment was to the bill as a whole rather than this amendment. So if I could just wait till that'd be better.
Very well. Anything else on the amendment? Representative Cass, obviously, you know, leave it to the will of the author. The intention is to lay this over for possible inclusion in the policy omnibus bill that would give us some time to work on this a little bit more at that point, so we can certainly do that. But I have to say that I, on line 1.3, I want to echo Representative Norton's advice. I've been here for a while, too, and I've seen a lot of conditional things that weren't meant to be conditional for a long period of time, but in fact continue to be. And I think it's our responsibility sometimes to bite the bullet and push forward on public policy issues. And so, there is some, obviously, you know, based on the last comments, there's real interest in this language of job embedded that is found on line 1.5 here.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't need to act on it now. We can certainly think about that because, as I said, we'll be laying this over. But, you know, just sort of giving you some indicators. And also for you, Representative Peterson, as well, perhaps we can spend some more time.
I believe that we do, Mr. Chair and committee members. I think that this is a work in progress, something that I want to see brought forward in an omnibus bill, and I think it's going to actually have a very positive impact on our teachers. As I have presented it to four different school districts and the teachers within those districts, and we'll be taking it to some others, there is a real need out there to look at reflection and what is actually already job-embedded and the work that teachers are doing, and what that meaning of that relicensure actually is at the end of those 5 years, and we can actually create that. Again, though, that I think this needs to be a combination of comments from all stakeholders, and there is a stakeholder that wants to see must to may. And again, it's that concept then that I think that needs to be flushed out, and I believe that we can do that before this actually goes before an omnibus bill.
We'll take one more question, and then we'll take action one way or the other on the amendment. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And a quick question for Representative Cass. The word must, could we consider that a mandate?
Some would say yes.
And if that is the case, thank you, Mr. Chairman. If that is the case, does this require a fiscal note, or is this an unfunded mandate?
Representative Cass.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, that is the question that comes forward, is saying that do school districts have enough of this job-embedded staff development already in place that it would not become an unfunded mandate, as well as how does the Board of Teaching read into this when it comes to how are they going to formulate the reflective practice? Is it going to be in a consistent form that they are going to bring forward so that the individual would fill this out just as they would any other application for relicensure? Or is the impetus going to be more on the school district to recognize what is the process by which the reflective practice and evidence would be brought forward? So again, I will state that I did not want to get into rulemaking authority, and that is really where the Board of Teaching is going to take this, and so that's where their guidance would be necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Peterson, your amendment is before us. You've heard the discussion. The bill, it is the intention to lay this bill over. We can certainly work on this language, or we can vote on your amendment at this point. Representative Peterson, your desires.
I'm sorry.
Do you want us to vote on the amendment?
Yes, I do. I think that this is an important piece because it is a transitional, it's transitioning from what is the current form, and it allows the current way that we relicense folks to move into this, to move into this new way of dealing at the site with a different way of judging reflective practice. And I think we need May in there so that we can use some of the current things that I think are still important that teachers can use in relicensure. So it's kind of combining what is current practice and what is the new way of doing things.
Very well. Representative, I do want to vote on this.
I know. Well, just to the Representative Burns' comment, or Benson's comment, whatever. They're just identical twins separated at birth.
Wow.
Anyway, this is a mandate on teachers, I think. And I just, to the author, I think if you have the same comment as a Norton comment, I think if you have me, you don't have a bill. And I think that having sat this place 11 years, when people may do things, they don't. And so, I just, that's your, my advice.
Thank you, Representative.
And Representative Abel, I would say, though, that, and Mr. Chair, I would say that what this does, it does direct the Board of Teaching to put together a plan that demonstrates that I may do this. And I'm going to tell you that I may, but I will, as a teacher under my continuing education. So the language does not state that I, as a teacher, will not be able to do this. I will do this because the Board of Teaching will be directed to put this into rule.
Thank you. Very helpful. Representative Peterson, then we'll vote, members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have to say that this will cost some dollars. It costs dollars for the Board of Teaching to put this into place, to begin to formulate this, to put it into rulemaking, and in many instances, retraining for those local committees that will make the determinations about whether to give relicensure or not. That's training. And in many instances, expanding the professional development that is already in a district. To me, when you want all of the things in here, which I think are excellent, by the way, mentoring, peer coaching, all of those things, then we have to assure that we have money for professional development, we have money to be able to do these things. So to me, this is an issue of funding also.
Very well. Members, are we ready to vote? All in favor of the A1 amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion does not prevail. Representative Kath, Representative Peterson, let's continue to work a little bit on this language together.
I'm good. Thank you.
Very well. Members, let's get to questioning. I'm sorry this took a little bit longer. I really want to push here. Representative Slales and Representative Norton.
I'll just be very brief. I want to thank Representative Kath for this bill. For the last 10 years, I have worked as a grade-level team leader where every week beyond the PLCs, I am working as a mentor to new teachers and other members at the same grade level, inviting new teachers to come in and observe me as I teach and introduce new material. It would be so great to be given continuing ed hours for this. I think this recognizes that children are not widgets, that there are different levels of learning and different styles of teaching that are needed in order to transmit information and for understanding. So I strongly urge support for this bill.
Thank you. Representative Norton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kath, I was looking on page 6 and line 6.18. You talk a lot in your bill about mentoring, and I, in my school district, are serving on the board. I strongly supported mentoring as often as I can, knowing that when I talk to young teachers, that the most important thing that they can get is a new teacher. I noticed on line 6.18 you mentioned emphasizing coaching professional learning, but you don't mention mentoring anywhere in that contents of the plan. And so I would just encourage you, I don't have an amendment right now, but as you move forward, because mentoring is such an important part of this, you might want to stick the word mentoring in there as an emphasis as well.
Thank you. Representative Demmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment. Representative, I do like this bill. We talked about this briefly, and I do have a couple of questions for you, and I'll try to be quick here and then let you expound. I'm interested in the alternative pay system in Section 7, Subdivision 2. You struck out the two areas that said objective, and it seems to me it's always important to teachers that things are objective as opposed to not being objective, and it's interesting that you took out objective in that evaluation. And I'd like you to comment on that, taking out objective and making those maybe softer, if you will. Secondly, just a comment, and you may want to comment on this too. it seems like there's a lot of emphasis here on the input, teacher inputs, going to school, doing more things, not much on student outcomes and student learning improvements and that sort of thing. I know there's some in there. If you would touch on that a little bit. And the last thing I would question or just ask you, do you think this would have an effect on whether or not a teacher would actually get relicensed? Could it effectively prevent somebody from getting relicensed if some of these things are not filled? Is that your intent, or do you think we're going that direction?
Representative Kapp. Thank you, Mr. Chair. First thing to your question is that under line 4.3, the reason that was changed is because effective evidence of effective practices that no longer under the subsections A and B are both of them evaluations any longer. So we struck out the term evaluation because that's not what the two things are doing anymore. It's an objective on the idea or the context is evidence of effective practice. A is an evaluation program. That's still in context, but there is an evaluation that's going to take place. B is going back towards the concept of instead of using locally trained evaluation team that understands teaching and learning to say that the professional, there's going to be reflection and growth in best teaching practices shown through support for student learning, collaborative work with colleagues, or continual professional learning consistent with section 122A.18. So in other words, what we're looking at here is that it's not just about evaluation, and evaluation is still going to be a component to this. But the second component is that we're going to bring teachers together in professional learning communities within other professional job-embedded staff development that's going to then provide evidence of effective practice. And I believe that that's what the purpose is. And I'll tell you the reason why this was placed in there, to answer your second question, is the idea that when we're talking about QConf and really what it is doing is that the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report said that it can't measure that student achievement is being brought forward because there's too many components to try and measure if one component, one input, QConf, is actually trying to move in that direction. So what I said is the one thing that it actually is doing is that it's offering an opportunity for effective teaching practice. And that's really what I'm encouraging here, is that if QConf is going to move forward, it has to move forward in the essence of what it's trying to do. I promise to my people back home that in any bill or anything that I propose or bring forward, that it's going to actually have a mission statement. That mission is going to be followed through. It's not going to be a mandate that has no effect. This has an effect. It's something that I can say, yes, by pushing this forward and saying that our school is going to receive those QConf dollars, this is how it's going to be measured. It's going to be measured by the fact that teachers are going to be more effective in their teaching practice. Beyond that, then, your final question of taking a look at the concept of would staff development programs or any of these things in context ever be brought forward to say that it's going to hinge on relicensure, I would say that it's already doing that. That what we're seeing here is that relicensure, that license itself that you're going to get in your continuing education, should be reflective of the fact that you are growing as a teacher. And I would hope that any sort of staff development program that we bring forward or any sort of concept that we say that is going to help a teacher is not going to be another hoop to jump through, but yet it's going to look at a system as a whole. And that's why this bill has gotten or kind of raised some flags to some individuals is because they're saying, wow, this is really wise. And that's the purpose of it, is to show that all of these things are so interconnected that we can no longer look at this as a context that none of these things are going to have an impact on one another. And so that's why the Office of the Legislative Auditor's report was brought into this, as well as the concept of QConf, because I said, if we are going to allow a school district to have QConf, I want it to be brought forward in best practice. And if that teacher, which still, under this whole concept, QConf is a program that is a may, if a school district wants to do this, it is a may. What it would say then is that your relicensure as a component of this, if you're going to be brought forward within this program, that you have an opportunity to say that this is going to help me advance as a teacher. And that's really what my purpose is.
This is a public hearing. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against the bill? Representative Flales, you get the last question, I believe. No? Oh, okay. I'm sorry. Ms. Altslager.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dan Altslager, Education Minnesota. We supported Representative Peterson's amendments, and we thought that made a lot of sense. And we understand that Representative Kapp is doing everything possible to change some of the relicensure, and we applaud his efforts. But we do have some serious concerns, but we are committed to working with Representative Kapp as we go forward.
Wonderful. Thank you. Members, Representative Kapp renews his motion. Oh, actually, we're not going to move on this. The idea is that we're going to lay this over for possible inclusion in an omnibus policy bill. So that'll be our action for today, and then we'll move on. Thank you, Representative Kapp, Ms. Sato, and Ms. Palmer, and members. Next, House File 1037, Representative Flales. Members, we started this bill Oh, I don't know. End of last week, I believe. Months ago, it seems. We're going to continue the discussion of the bill. Before I do that, members, I want to just very quickly give you a heads up of scheduling issues for next week, so you'll want to pay attention to this. We obviously will meet on our 3 days. At this point, you know, we're basically 2 weeks away from our policy deadline, and we've got a number of bills, mostly small bills, but we have a couple of potentially big bills that we're looking to line up here. And so at this point, I would like you to keep your evenings open on Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. Right now, I'm looking at a Wednesday, hopefully the only evening, hopefully. There are Representative Flowers Committee meets on Tuesday and Thursdays at 4:30, and several of us are on her committee, so it would make for a pretty rough day, but nonetheless, and you don't meet on Wednesdays, so that's why I'm thinking Wednesday evening would be our kind of evening meeting. I'm also looking at a Friday morning meeting at the same time, at 8:30. I realize that's going to be perhaps a bit of an issue for Representative Murdoch and Demmer, a few others who have to travel a distance. But hopefully it'll be the only time that we'll need to do that. But 8:30 on Friday, next Friday. Not this Friday. No. So anyway, heads up on that. And then just another brief, this is an advertising. Last night, Charlie Rose, so I don't know if you ever watched it, but he interviewed the Secretary of Education. Of course, as you know, the President made a major address on education issues with some of the Hispanic Chamber, National Hispanic Chamber, where he basically laid out an outline of the administration's approach. I had a brief discussion with Commissioner Segrin yesterday, who was in D.C. a couple of days ago, and it's pretty clear in her mind that there are, in fact, some very strong contours that are taking place that are offering some potential opportunities for states like Minnesota, who I think still continues to be on the cutting edge of good education policy here. So anyway, all that by way of encouraging you. You can go online, apparently. I tried it last night, but they hadn't updated, or they hadn't downloaded it yet. But you can go online and to Charlie Rose's website and watch a video of that interview. So with that, Representative Swales, we've got House File 1037. And I guess our motion here is that it be recommended to pass and re-refer to the public safety policy.
Mr. Chairman, I did talk to the CAE yesterday.
Mr. Tuma, why don't you identify yourself for the record?
My apologies. My name is John Tuma with the Minnesota Association of Christian Home Educators. I did talk to them with Section 1 being removed as it is in the Delete Everything Amendment. I think it was their wish that they don't need to see it after.
All right. So why don't we just proceed, and then we'll take care of the motion. At this point, though, the motion would be that it be recommended to pass.
And I move that House File 1037 be recommended to pass and re-refer to Finance.
Very well. The motion is before us. And Representative Swales, you have a DE1 amendment. Did we move that the last time, or are we moving that now? Representative Swales moved the DE1 amendment. Members, you have that in your packet. Representative Swales. This is a delete everything amendment, so you're basically putting this in the shape that you want the bill before us, and we'll need you then to explain to us. I mean, we'll act on it, but we'll need you to explain what's particularly being taken out. So, members, the D1 amendment is before us. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Swales.
Mr. Chair and members, it was the superintendents and other school officials who began the session indicating that they would like reduced paperwork and mandates for public schools as it relates to homeschooling. The homeschool community concurred and worked to develop a comprehensive bill. The homeschool groups have worked collaboratively with the School Board Association, Superintendents Association, County Attorneys Association, Public Health Nurses, Department of Health, Physicians, Department of Public Safety, Department of Labor and Industry, and anyone else who wanted to work collaboratively to reduce mandates.
The bill gives the state an opportunity to save a little money. And I want to reintroduce my good friend here. This is Alex Johnson and her mother, Athene Johnson.
Buenos días, Alex. ¿Cómo estás? Qué bueno. Qué gusto verte. Qué bueno. Representative Soil.
I would like to introduce Athene Johnson, board member of the Minnesota Homeschool Alliance. You're not a board member. Okay. A member of the Minnesota Homeschool Alliance and the state's largest non-sectarian group, and John Tuma from the SAGE walked through each of the sections of the Delete Everything Amendment to make sure everyone is comfortable and has consensus on this bill.
Very well. Who's gonna be the first? Mr. Tuma.
Mr. Chair, members, I'll take off. And before I get started, Mr. Chair, I appreciated our conversation last time. I think you, as usually, tweaked my curiosity, and I've always liked serving with you because you always make me think a little bit. And one of the things that you mentioned was, you know, the state's constitutional obligation with regards to education. And so I went back and I actually looked at that, and it really kind of did set the context of, I think, what Marsha and our Representative Swales is trying to accomplish here. And if you look at Article 8, Section 1 of the Constitution, it's entitled Uniform System of Public Education. It reads, "The stability of a Republican form of government," I'm sure they meant to include the Democrats too, but
yes, indeed.
"a Republican form of government depends mainly on the intelligence of the people. It is the duty of the legislature to establish a general and uniform system of public education. The legislature shall make such provisions by taxation and otherwise as will secure the thorough and efficient system of a public school throughout the state." And that's really what I think our goal was here, is to work effectively with our school administrators under a new paradigm. You actually had a fancy word there, Mr. Chair, earlier, a paradigmical way. I had to think about it for a second. But there is really a new paradigm from what is now the relationship with public schools and homeschoolers. In 1987, nobody really knew what this new thing was. There was a lot of insecurity about it. But now in 2009, there really is a new relationship, Mr. Chair, and our superintendents have a tough job to do. I think Representative Cass laid out very clearly some of the difficult things they have to work on. And so our goal here was not to deregulate, was just simply to change the regulations so that they better reflect the real positive working relationship we have. There's two things I want you to keep in mind as I walk through this bill so that you can put it in context. First, don't panic. You are not going to have 15 passenger vans doing NASCAR donuts in your public school lawn with the little kids mooning the superintendent. That's not going to happen. Our homeschool parents take very seriously their job of teaching their kids, and they love doing it. And it's not the reporting that encourages that. It's not the extra paperwork, some of it very silly, that enhances that desire of our parents to home educate our kids or do a very good job. Minnesota is considered a high regulation state, and after you pass these provisions in Representative Swales' bill, we'll probably be about a medium regulation state. We're not going as far as states like Illinois and Michigan have. We'll be pretty much a medium regulation state. All recent studies have shown that regulations have absolutely no impact on the measure of students' academic achievements when they're homeschooled. Nor does it keep children safe from abuse. I know that a lot of people are worried about that, and in my years of being involved in this movement, I have not seen one instance where the reporting statutes have actually tripped up the bad guys. There are bad guys out there. There are bad guys in our police office, our police forces. There are bad guys in our nursing homes. There are bad guys in our schools, and there are bad guys in our daycare. It's not the regulations in this particular case that get the bad guys. Frankly, the reason they get caught is because our families are not afraid to turn in the bad guys. And there's a simple reason for that. Our homeschool moms are mother bears, okay? And there's one adage when you camp, you don't get between a mother bear and her cub, okay? That almost happened to me one time in the Boundary Waters on the way up to the Biffy, and I didn't turn and run very fast. I flew out of there because it's a dangerous situation. Our mothers are very committed to educating their children.
Representative Tuma, you would have us believe you can outrun a black bear?
In that situation, I was. And I had to wait quite a while before I went back up, too. So. Mr. Chair, you know, our folks are willing to work with their communities. They're part of our community, and they will not allow bad things to happen. In every instance I've seen, it's mothers who have turned in people who are being abusive, and they're not afraid to do that. And so much so, too, that they're also willing to work together, Mr. Chairman. We have support groups all over the state of Minnesota, and our mothers are willing to come alongside other mothers, and we have a very successful support group structure throughout the state of Minnesota. And you know, Mr. Chair, the second principle I want you to understand, our superintendents understand this. They have really backed down on a regulatory relationship. They want to establish not a regulatory prosecutorial relationship, they want to establish cooperative relationships. And so that second principle is that this has really come forward because of them. And for example, Representative Nornes in Fergus Falls, the superintendent up there gets it. He actually opened up his school district's building because he had some extra space and encouraged the homeschool co-op to come in and do their science classes in their science labs and to use their public school gym free of charge. Okay, why? Because he has available space, and he knows when those students are going to make the choice, very good students want to make that choice to take an advanced English course from someone like a super teacher like Marcia Swales or other super teachers that are out there. He wants them to think first about that public school as opposed to doing it PSEO or taking it online from Northwestern College. And so what you see is the superintendent's really looking at this relationship totally different and wanting to get out of the role of having to be the bad guy prosecutor. And therefore, keep those things in mind when I run through the bill real quickly. I think Representative Swales' bill helps create a new way of doing business between a new paradigm, that may be, between homeschoolers and the public school, and that is a one of cooperation.
And Mr. Tuma, we've got a little over 20 minutes left in the hearing.
And I should be able to...
So I want to make sure we do. I understand you were laying a basis here, but we're going to need to move to the bill quickly so that the committee members can attack.
Very good, Mr. Chair. Section 1 of the bill, Mr. Chair and members. Actually, I'm working off the DE1 amendment, so I'm not on the bill. In fact, Section 1 of the bill is now deleted. After concerns that we had from the county attorneys regarding some of the changes we were making there, again, consensus model, we removed Section 1 of the bill. So Section 1 of the DE amendment is assessments. We felt this required us to continue to do assessments. We think that's appropriate. You will see in the next section that intertwines with students reentering the public school, that those assessment scores will be made available to the school districts upon the student entering into there. We delete some language regarding a 30% standard. Folks, if my child's score below 60%, I'm going to worry about it. Just because you put an arbitrary number in statute doesn't really mean anything, but I think it's important that we send a message that doing the tests are important. We also add in there the fact that you can take the ACT and SAT tests to qualify there. Really no reason for a student who's taking college entrance exams to also have to be doing the Iowa Basic test at the same time. Section 2, Mr. Chair, we are reporting everything we've had reported before to the school district, except for two things. One is we're not going to be reporting report cards anymore. Superintendents never understood why they got them in the first place, and so we're going to delete that. And we also delete the calendar. And I'll throw this one over to Ms. Johnson because I think she can point out kind of what homeschoolers thought of this calendar idea.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson.
Mr. Chair,
and you'll need to state your name for the record as well.
My name is Athene Johnson, and just on the point of the calendar, for homeschoolers, it's really completely arbitrary because every single day is a learning day at my house, and I've yet to meet a homeschooler who doesn't do the same thing. There might be days when our learning is less formalistic. Like my daughter just said, Saturdays and Sundays is less formalistic, more casual, but we're learning every single day. And to put an arbitrary number like 180 days, it really doesn't mean anything to homeschoolers because we learn all the time.
Thank you. Mr. Tuma.
And Mr. Chair, for the Northern Legislators, my school starts after Labor Day, so just so you know. we also include in Section 2, the Subdivision 2 there, which is availability of documents. We make it very clear that if a student goes back into the public school full-time, that they need to provide the necessary documents and testing scores so the student can be appropriately placed within the school. And we think that's the law right now, but we wanted to make it very clear. We put this language in at the behest of the School Board Association and the superintendents. Subdivision 3 and 4 are language changes that were suggested by the superintendents in their bill. It was in the Tilbury bill originally, but we put it in the Swales bill, really just simplifying their reporting requirements. Sections 3, 4, and 5, members, is the part where we're really taking the superintendents out of being the regulator slash prosecutor simplifying that system for them. If there is a violation of this reporting statute, they would then indicate to the county attorney, who would then send a letter to the family with 15 days to correct that. If they don't correct it, it goes through the existing mediation fact-finding process at the Department of Education. This is very effective. In all my years of doing this, this is where most of the problems are solved. What the superintendent didn't like was the fact that before, under the old law, they would actually have to submit this directly to the Department of Education. And they often felt like they were the prosecutor, and they would go in front of the Department of Education and have to argue, and they would get letters from our attorneys saying, you shouldn't be doing this, and they would have to run and get their attorneys to calm them down, and it really was a loss of time for those superintendents. And what we're trying to do is de-escalate that a little bit, let the department handle that. If we do have a family that's being uncooperative, they really should get a letter from the county attorney, because these are not very hard standards to meet. That gets the superintendent out of feeling like they have to sit there and be the prosecutor at the Department of Education. And the Department of Education does a great job. I've never seen any cases prosecuted. There's only one reported case under this statute, and that was a family back in the 90s who were actually just challenging the constitutionality of the law. They lost. It's constitutional law. So, folks, very rarely does anything go beyond this level, and most of it is resolved there. If it isn't, that mediator would submit it back to the county attorney for possible prosecution. Remember, Section 6 is the immunization section. Under the present law, we were required to report every year. And so we had families going back and getting their records annually and submitting them to the school district, paying $15 or $20 for copying their immunization records and submitting it to the school district. Well, in this process, the good thing, we found out when we talked to the Department of Health, they didn't want the documents annually. They only wanted it when we first started school, when you had your initial immunization, so we can prove that we have those immunizations, and then when we get our booster shots at 7th grade. So they were happy to say, look, you only have to send them in when you first start, and then when your child reaches 7th grade. Section 8 and 9, members, is the cost savings for the state. This is eliminating homeschoolers' availability to the non-public pupil aid. The way we define homeschools in Minnesota, we are essentially under the same regulatory statutes as Brecht or SPA or St. Teresa's Catholic School, okay? And because of that, our families could submit requests for non-public pupil aid, about $77 for textbooks, and then there's also a few other ones that families don't typically use. This system is very good for St. Teresa's, okay? When St. Teresa's fills out their report for their 100 students, they send in one single report for all 100 students saying, these are how many students we have, this is how much aid we have. School district, please buy us this book. And that's critical because Section 2 of the Constitution under Article 8 says that you cannot give direct support to sectarian schools. And so what happens is your school district has to actually physically purchase the books and loan them to your private schools. And then the private schools are supposed to give those books back when they're done using them. That system works very good on the scale of St. Teresa's, where they have 100 students. Now lay that with 100 homeschool families in your district. Those 100 homeschool families send in 100 separate different reports, asking for 100 separate different set of books, and this creates a lot of conflict with the school district. You'll have one family saying, oh, we want Bob Jones Math. Bob Jones Math should be purchased. That's not sectarian. And you get a battle with the administrators. This is one of the most difficult and complicated things to administer. This is a huge sacrifice for our families. We did not come easily to saying we're willing to give this up in this mandate reduction package. But I felt that we'd be totally disingenuous in calling this a homeschool, public school mandate reduction bill if we didn't put this on the table and say, look, this is really the most complicated, most difficult set of paperwork that your school district has when it interacts with our private schools. And so it's only fair that this be there. It is a huge sacrifice. Just for the textbook aid, it's about $1.1 million. that you will be able to save. Now, don't panic. You're not leaving homeschool families out in the cold. You have a very good tax credit deduction system for educational purposes that's out there, that's income-based and fair. You will still, after passing this bill, have one of the most generous provisions for people to purchase educational materials in the nation. It's highly recognized. It's been followed in several states. I've had several homeschool associations contact me from other states asking how Minnesota does our tax credit induction system. They don't ask us how we do our non-public pupil. They don't want that. They really appreciate the efficiencies that are created with our educational tax credit system. Mr. Chair, really quickly, the last sections 9, 10, and 11, and 12 are a lot of verbiage to do two very simple things, okay? We work with the Department of Labor and Industry, work with the Department of Public Safety. Right now, we're required to basically ask the superintendent for a letter saying that our child can take a correspondence course that is presently under the law to take for our driver's ed, and then also if the child is working during school hours. Parents have to authorize it. We figured, why are we asking the superintendent to produce one more piece of paper when we can directly apply to the department for this program and require that the department can, if they choose to, verify this information from the superintendent. So it's really saving your superintendent having to do a letter when we can simply sign off and say, yes, we're homeschooling. And by the way, if we lie, it's a crime. And if we lie, our child loses the license, and that will be more than likely on the form. There is one technical change that we'll need to make, and the department is here on that, and so I'll call them up here afterwards, Mr. Chair, if that works. But
Mr. Tuma, we have 11 minutes left,
and I'm done.
And I have four hearings left before, well, that's not true, but seven hearings left. We don't act on this bill today. We may not act.
I'm done, Mr. Chair. That is it.
Mr. Tuma, very quickly, on page, I think it's page six, so we're getting to the driver training. Issue. I believe that if, with this provision here, this bill, if it's still here, I think this bill is going to have to go to public safety. Do you care to comment on that?
Mr. Chair, I did ask them. I walked through the legislation. Actually, this section is really, I think, under the jurisdiction of Representative Frank Hornstein's
committee. Transportation committee. Yeah,
and I did talk to them. I'm happy to go anywhere I have to go. And certainly, I think if it goes up, we'll talk to them again.
We can certainly move the bill according to what Representative Wales' desires, but I'm just signaling that the Transportation Department, or rather Transportation Committee, would want to hear the bill, then our rules would probably say that it needs to go.
And I'm perfectly fine, Mr. Chair, with that. It is a pretty minor change. Again, it's not. I know there's a discussion about this online learning stuff. That's not in here. We're not doing that. This is only simply reducing one piece of paper.
We'll be hearing that bill next week as well. Yes. Mr. Tuma, our staff is wrestling with the notion that superintendents are removed from sharing or how the information would get to the county attorney. The superintendents are removed from sharing the information about the compulsory age law. Can you tell us how that's going to work?
Well, Mr. Chair, no different than any other matter getting to the county attorney. If I see a violation of a law, I would refer that to the appropriate county authorities to do that. The superintendents, I believe, are going to be very much aware that if they see a specific violation, say a family sends in their report and refuses to give the age of the child, which is required under the statute, I'm going to guess that most of our superintendents aren't going to play gotcha and just ship it right off to the county attorney, but they're going to contact the family and say, can you fill this in? Then if they don't, if they're just being obstinate jerks, that county attorney can get a report from a truancy officer. If that school has a truancy officer, can get a report from a superintendent. They get a report from a citizen and bring an action. That's the county attorney's complete authority to do that. And so my guess is that how it would happen in most instances where a family, if they were being obstinate, would be that he would just send a letter to the county attorney saying, by the way, family XY has refused to send in this information.
Mr. Tuma, and I understand the desire here in terms of a mandate, if you will, the superintendents. I'm just a little concerned that it feels a little mushy. We do have a strong expectation in our state that whether it's in homeschool or any other setting that in fact our young are attending schools, and that we have clear ways to know that and timely ways to know that. So I'm just putting it out there. But you know what? I'm going to move to a number of other questions. You can certainly circle back to answer that. Representative Abler and Representative Greiley. And we're going to move quick, members.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I'll be quick. We homeschool. We did a charter school. Our kids have graduated from charter school, Ananoka High School, and we've done everything that you can do within PSEO. Just want to remind people that this is a different model. This is Apple compared to the IBM guy. And I want to remind you that, again, quoting our statutes, 128.22, the parent of the child is primarily responsible for ensuring the child acquires knowledge, and et cetera. This is the law. This is one of the first sections under school attendance. And just to remind us that in the past we've said that, and these are parents who do it, and it's exhausting. We got tired and quit doing it. And the worst thing about it is every day is a learning day. And so, the kids ask the question, they're like, well, what do you think it would be? I'm like, yeah, just tell me the answer, because you're always a teacher. And every day is, but it's a beautiful thing. You get to know your kids. And I just encourage us as this moves forward. I'm the second author on the bill because I understand the process and the need for this. It can be buffed and chined along the way. But the scores and the outcomes are what we're driving toward on all these kinds of families. And that's our goal, right, to have high. The scores on these kids are really high. Even on kids that are troubled in the traditional public school system, sometimes they go home and the flexibility and the one-on-one saves some of these kids. So I hope we can, this bill can move along, and at least most of these things can become law.
Thank you. Members, let's be brief. Representative Baylor. Then Representative Downey next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Tuma, how do you figure that this is saving money when you're going from non-public student aid to tax credits?
Very briefly, Mr. Tuma.
Mr. Chair, the big savings is first for you because it comes out of your budget. So that $1 million will be credited to you. If there is additional education dollars that are absorbed out of the tax credit deduction, it's a different system. You only get 75% if you have you're entitled to a tax credit. And so that family, if they get the tax credit, are still going to only get 75% of the value of the book. And then the deduction is pretty minor compared to, I qualify the deduction, that's only talking about 2-3% savings essentially on those books. So you're still going to have a significant savings. More than likely, these families, though, are not going to make the school district buy a brand new book. Our moms are smart. They're going to go out and probably buy the used curriculum. And it's going to be a lot cheaper than overall for the whole system. And I think you will not see that same kind of matriculation over dollar for dollar into the tax credit system. It'll be quite a bit less. And so you'll have a big savings in your budget. Taxes, if they want to credit something to the value. There could be some more families using the tax credits. And we'll encourage that.
And we could vet that further in Representative Gravely's committee, assuming the bill moves forward. Representative Downey and Representative Faust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. With the backdrop of a uniform public education system in Minnesota, I'm curious why in Section 1 we wouldn't require homeschooled kids to take the same battery of kind of Minnesota state-sanctioned tests that we require the traditional public school kids, and why there wouldn't be some kind of, whether it's mandated or not, or whether it's a forced compliance, overseen thing, why we wouldn't have homeschool parents reporting poor performance in some way or having some remediation for poor performance.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Downing, if that was a problem, I would probably agree with you, but it hasn't been a problem. Most families are working very diligently to take care of that, those issues. Our association has a special needs coordinator designed simply to help families with special needs children. We even have school districts that work with those families. If that family wants to get an IEP, they still, under the law, are entitled to that IEP and can still homeschool their kids. And so the structures are out there. The districts are working with these families. So just by putting an arbitrary thing in the statute saying X, Y, or Z in this situation really, I think, doesn't reflect the relationships that are developing with our public schools and our homeschool community. let that happen organically. It's happening very well organically. And frankly, a lot of people homeschool because they don't want to be tied to a test. They want to find that test that best fits the style of education they're doing. My daughter has a very different learning style than my son, and we do two separate tests because of that, because she is much more verbal, and so we take tests that reflect that and reflect that those skill levels for her. I don't know, Dean, your experience with that or not.
We're going to need to move on. Mr. Tuma, and I think Representative Abler tried to lay this basis for us about the unique nature, if you will, the Apple versus the Mac issue. But I have to tell you, I honestly struggle with the notion of sort of allowing organic processes to go forward when it comes to anything that we, by you know, Constitution and state law, think it's very important for us to provide, at the very least, some elements of strong oversight and documentation. So that's what I'm honestly struggling with. I'm not empathetic at all here, but you know, the same arguments can be made in a number of other areas that we legislate here, and that's in terms of sort of trusting and organic, and I'm all about trust and organic processes, but you know, I also like transparency and documentation, you know, et cetera. So that's kind of the tension that I'm feeling. Representative Faust, and then before Representative Faust, if there's anyone in the audience that wishes to testify, please kind of make your way forward here. Representative Faust, I'm sorry, what?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's actually quite a bit in here that I really like. I appreciate that. There's some that I can live with, but there's two points that I really have a hard time with. One was the point that was just brought up by Representative Downey in Section 1. Why are we not exposing these kids to the same test, and why isn't there this 30, you know, if they're not at least meeting 30%, there's a problem, and we need to do something about that. And so I really have a hard time accepting that. And the second thing is on the very next page, on 2.26, 2.27, where we're no longer going to require them to provide the name of the instructor and the evidence of compliance that they're meeting this Section 120A.22. I just think that's the lowest level of any accountability, is that, you know, to at least make sure the teacher is got some kind of standards there that they're meeting. And so those are the two things out of all of this that I really have a hard time with.
I'll answer the second one first.
Mr. Tuma, we've got 2 minutes left here.
The answer is no, they're still providing that information. We just moved it. And so don't get confused by that.
Representative Benson.
Not to be flippant, Mr. Chairman, but there was a famous president one time said that you should trust and verify.
Indeed. I'm sorry, Ms. Johnson, you wanted to weigh
Mr.
in.
Mr. Chairman, members, trust and verify, I appreciate that phrase. And actually, if you look at the research out there, there's already verification that homeschool students are scoring at or above the levels on these nationally normed reference tests as public schools. And I guess I'm confused as to why there's a desire to impose the same exact test as what they're taking in public schools. And recall, too, that I have a daughter in public schools. She's actually been in a guinea pig year. They tested her every year, tried out, I mean, every single year, some years two times a year. And I think we're over-testing our kids already in public school. But from a homeschool standpoint, the requirement is already there, and it's not being removed, that we implement a nationally norm reference test every year. And these kids in the data, it's showing that they're performing very well. And I appreciate the concern about 30%. I would have a huge concern if my daughter were that low. If it were 31%, would it be any different than 30%? To me, it's an arbitrary line, and homeschool parents are not going to worry at 30. We're going to worry up at 60 or 70, you know, and that's just, I don't know if that helps.
Representative Foster, if you can do it under 5 seconds.
I can do it under 5 seconds. My concern is, and this is a superintendent of mine talking, is that some parents do an absolutely fantastic job. They do it for all the right reasons, and they put their heart and their soul into it. Others are doing it because they don't want to get up to make the kid get to school on time. And that's not mine, that's the superintendent talking. And that's the group that I'm concerned about, not the ones that are like you that are doing a great job.
And Mr. Chairman, and members, very quickly, I've never met a family like that.
Thank you. I don't see anyone else in the public coming down, is that correct? I do see someone. We're obviously going to run over here. Representative Gramling, it's not my desire to have kind of big policy things determined in your committee, so I'm wanting to make sure it takes
we'll,
the policy issues get taken care of here.
And we're willing
is
to
there anyone else in the public that wishes to come down? Representative Swales, you're at the point where you're renewing your motion.
I'd like to renew my motion.
And I'm sorry, Representative Swales, I'm sorry we did not formally vote on the DE1 amendment, which puts the bill in the form. We did?
Yeah, we did.
Okay. All right. It's always good to check. So please, Ms. Representative Swales.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion that House file 1037 be re-referred to be recommended to pass and re-referred to Education Finance.
To the Finance Committee.
To the Finance Committee.
Very well. Members, are you ready to vote?
Yep.
All in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Swales.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Members, we are adjourned until next Tuesday at 8:30.